You have 30 minutes to use in whichever way you would like.
Well, thank you very much, Madam Chair, and thank you so much for your generous introduction to come and be here today. And Senator Inhofe, thank you for your words of welcome, and I look forward to questions and an exchange of views here. To my fellow Tennessean, Lamar Alexander, Senator Alexander, Lamar, thank you so much for your kind words and your warm welcome. And I want to note for the committee what I'm sure most of you know. Senator Alexander, as governor of our state, was associated with keen attention to environmental protection in a way that was quite sensitive to economic development, and is part of a tradition that includes the Senator Baker and others from the time when the issue of protecting the environment was genuinely a bipartisan issue. And some of us believe that it's not now and should be. I understand there are differences in the way that would be phrased here today, but I want to acknowledge the record of one of my senators, Lamar Alexander. And Senator Mikulski and I served together in the House of Representatives, as she noted, and in this chamber. And there were multiple pieces of legislation that had our two names on them, and it was always a pleasure and an energizing experience to work with Senator Mikulski. And I'm honored, Barbara, that you would come and do this here today. Thank you so much. To the other members of the committee, I've got so many close friends on this committee. Forgive me for not going down the aisle, but I want to acknowledge my respect for all the members of the committee. My father served here in this chamber, and I was reflecting this morning on the differences that have occurred since he first came to Washington in 1938. And there are all kinds of jokes about the hot air on Capitol Hill. I'm not going to make those jokes, but I am going to refer to the air on Capitol Hill, because when he came here in 1938, there were around about 300 parts per million of CO2 in the air that he and his colleagues in this Senate breathed. And today it's 383 parts per million. It didn't really go above 300 parts per million for at least a million years back, maybe longer, but in the Antarctic ice record, that's about as far back as they can go. And even though the Earth has gone through all these big swings in natural cycles, the CO2 content never went above 300 parts per million in all that time. And just in the short span of time from my father's first service in the Capitol here and today, it's gone up a dramatic amount. And more CO2 means warmer temperatures. There really should be no doubt about that. That's been known for 180 years. And for at least 100 years, they've known roughly how much the temperature would go up with the what concentrations of extra CO2. For most of human history, we lived on the harvested energy that came from the sun, and it was a net energy balance. And then with the beginning of the use of coal and then oil and other fossil fuel supplies, we began to use the accumulated reservoirs of hundreds of millions of years worth of accumulated solar energy. And of course, that meant returning carbon to the atmosphere in very large quantities. And from the early days of that period, there were a few scientists who said, wait a minute, that's going to have some consequences. And it did. And it has now reached a point where we've literally changed the radiative balance between the Earth and the sun. And the scientists who study global warming gained a lot of their expertise by looking at the other planets in the solar system and Mars has just 1% of the Earth's atmosphere, and the temperature is not 15 degrees centigrade or 59 Fahrenheit. It's 55 below zero on average because the CO2 doesn't trap the heat. Venus, by contrast, has much more CO2, and the temperature is above the boiling point of lead, and it rains sulfuric acid. Not the kind of weather forecast you'd want to see in the morning. And it's not because Venus is closer to the sun, because it's much hotter than Mercury, even though Mercury's right next to the sun. It's the CO2. This is extremely well established, well understood, and well known. Senator Boxer, I want to start off by saying that there's really hardly any way to overestimate or overstate the degree of hope that people out in our country have because of what you're doing, because of what this new Senate and Congress, everybody hopes will do. This is not a normal time. We are facing a planetary emergency. And I'm fully aware that that phrase sounds shrill to many people's ears, but it is accurate. The relationship between humankind and planet Earth has been radically altered in a very short period of time. And what would make us believe that we could go through these changes and not have an impact on the planet? We've quadrupled human population in less than 100 years, from 1.6 billion in 1900 to 6.56 billion today. And that's stabilizing of its own accord as girls are educated and women are empowered and girls and women gain literacy and as family planning that's culturally acceptable is made more widely available in every nation. And most importantly, as infant mortality goes down and maternal and infant health standards go up, the death rates come down first, and then after a few years, the birth rates come down, and the population of the Earth is stabilizing. But with a 4 times increase in less than a century, our impact on the planet has been dramatically changed. Secondly, and more importantly, the technologies we have at our disposal today are thousands of times more powerful than any that our grandparents had available to them. And that makes all of our activities more effective and productive, but it also makes us sometimes like the proverbial bull in a china shop, and we're capable of doing damage that we're not always fully aware that we're doing. And, of course, the common assumption is the Earth is so big we couldn't possibly have a lasting harmful impact on it. But the most vulnerable part of the Earth's ecological system, the scientists tell us, is the atmosphere. It's so thin, the number of molecules is known. They say it's 10 to the 44, which is above my pay grade, but sounds like a big number. But compared to what we're able to put into it every hour of every day now, it's not that big. Just a few miles from here to the top of the sky before we can't breathe anymore, and so we're changing its composition. We're putting 70 million tons every day of this global warming pollution into the Earth's atmosphere. And as you noted, Madam Chair, 25 million tons go into the oceans every day, and that's literally making the oceans more acidic. But where the atmosphere is concerned, that extra CO2 is retaining in the atmosphere much more of the outgoing infrared that normally escapes back into space and keeps the normal healthy balance within which humankind has developed and within which all of our civilization has evolved and all the cities have been located and all the ports and the places where the rain can be predicted to fall reliably enough for agriculture. And we're putting all those patterns at risk. The 10 hottest years ever measured in the record have been since 1990. 20 of the 21 hottest years have been since in the last 25 years. The hottest year of all was 2005. The hottest year of all in the U.S. was 2006. The hottest winter ever measured worldwide was this winter, December, and then January and February of this year, last month. This is going on right now. And it's continuing to increase. And the scientific leaders of the world have given us the fourth unanimous report in less than 15 years. They gathered this time in Paris 6 weeks ago. And they said the evidence supporting this consensus is, and I quote them, unequivocal. Unequivocal. Scientific American had a special issue in September that began with an article that said the debate on global warming is over. The editor-in-chief of Science magazine said it's extremely rare to have a consensus as strong as the one supporting the consensus view on man-made global warming. It's real. We're causing it mainly, vast majority of it. The consequences are bad and will be catastrophic unless we act. We can act. We can solve it. There's still time. And we have everything we need to get started. Those points are in agreement. One of the leading scientific experts said the consensus supporting this view on global warming is as strong as anything in science, with the possible exception of gravity. This is a challenge to our moral imagination, because the natural tendency for me, for all of us, is to think that something this big and this challenging is not real. We don't want it to be real. It's hard to think about. Contemplating changes to deal with it automatically creates a feeling of discomfort. We just wish it would go away. It's not going away. We've got to deal with it. And as I started to say, Madam Chair, the people out there in our country are so hopeful that this Senate will act and that this Congress will act. And they know how hard it is. I want you to know that there's a big change in public opinion that's building out there. I'm going to deliver to your offices. I didn't bring all the boxes with me from the House side where I spoke this morning, but they're being delivered electronically to your offices. We just started asking. I have a site called AlGore.com, and just a few days ago we started asking people to join in presenting this statement, and 516,000 Americans signed it just in the last several days. And we've been getting new names at the rate of 100 per second. This shouldn't be seen as a partisan issue. Sometimes you'll hear people say that and you think, oh, it's just boilerplate, it's a throwaway, and you're just trying to get some Republicans to vote for it. This really shouldn't be seen as a partisan issue or even a political issue. It's a moral issue. There are some times in history when a small number of people in one place have to make difficult decisions that will affect the future for everybody. One of the most popular movie out there now is 300. I haven't seen it, but the young people love it, and it's about the Battle of Thermopylae in 480 BC when, Senator Warner, you're a great military historian, and I would love to hear you talk about this sometime. As you know, 300 saved the future of Western civilization against 10,000. One of the great stories of courage when a few made a decision for the many. The greatest generation, the label we give to the generation that won World War II and defeated fascism in the Atlantic and the Pacific simultaneously, rose to the challenge of fascism and, in process, saved our country. Significantly, when they came back here, no longer 19, 20, 21-year-olds, they found that they had gained moral authority. Senator Warner, you were one of the youngest members of that generation. Weren't you a part of World War II? God bless you, and thank you. Thank you. And when your generation came back, the GI's General Omar Bradley said, now is the time when we've got to steer by the stars and not by the lights of every passing ship. Another general, George Marshall, said, let's go and lift our adversaries from the battlefield, from their knees, and walk with them toward self-determination and prosperity. And your generation said, yes. And you adopted a 50-year horizon and established the institutions that help this world move in a positive and favorable direction. And you know what? They don't export world wars from Europe anymore, because a United Nations was established in your hometown, Senator Boxer, and then a lot of other steps were taken. Our mutual predecessor, Cordell Hull, helped establish the world trading system, reciprocal free trade, as he would always remind us to say. Now, this generation and this Senate faces such a challenge. The few. The stakes are high. The time is now. The people are hopeful. It can be done. I just came last week from the United Kingdom. And I met with not only the Chancellor of the Exchequer and leaders of the Labour Party in power there, but also the Tories. And I met with their entire front bench, 80 of them. And both of their major parties are unified in their determination to solve this climate crisis. It's not partisan. They're competing with one another. They've got an election coming up probably later this year. Who knows? Their system's different, you know, but they're competing vigorously with one another. But they're competing on the basis of which party can offer the most creative and meaningful solutions to this crisis. They're not arguing about the science. They're arguing about how to design solutions that'll go farther, faster. And they joined with all of their European neighbors just last week when I was over there to adopt a much tougher reduction, mandatory reduction in CO2, 20%, and 30% if we join in the global effort to address this crisis. We're the leaders of the world. The United States of America are the leaders of the world, and the members of the Senate and the House in this legislative branch of government are the ones. History of freedom is the history of legislative bodies. In that time after World War II, what made it possible for that greatest generation to claim that title and change the world after saving the world was Republicans, led by Senator Arthur Vandenberg and others, stood and said, we're Americans first, and we see the challenge. And we're going to do the uncommonly difficult. We're going to do our duty as we see it. Now is such a time. We've got too much partisanship. Every one of us, myself at the front of the line, has contributed too much to it. But a time will come I promise you, a time will come when a future generation will look back on 2007 at this hopeful time, and they will ask one of two questions. Either they will ask, what in God's name were they doing? Didn't they see the evidence? Didn't they hear the warnings? Didn't they see the mountain glaciers melting in every part of this earth? Didn't they see the North Polar ice cap melting? Didn't they hear the scientists say it may be gone in as little as 34 years? Didn't they hear the seismographers telling them that the earth is shaking because of the glacial earthquakes on Greenland? 32 of them this year, up to 5.1 on the Richter scale. Didn't they see the evidence of nature being on the run? Senator Alexander, we had a, I'm sure maybe you saw this. I get clippings and whatnot that other people don't necessarily get. Manatees live in South Florida. One of them showed up off Memphis this summer. Yeah, first time ever. You ever seen a manatee in Memphis? No. It got too hot in southern Florida. I'm not making this up. Another one showed off of Cape Cod. First time ever. Nature is on the run. Senator Inhofe, there were some big fires in Oklahoma last year. All over the West, there have been these big fires. A brand new study in the scientific peer-reviewed literature now definitively links it to global warming. When there's an earlier spring melt and the precipitation doesn't keep the soil moist enough, the soil dries out from the higher temperatures and the vegetation dries out, and they call that kindling. And all over the West, the fires have been raging out of control. They've got mega fires in Australia now and what some of them call a 1,000-year drought. Fires across Russia also. I want to talk to you a little bit about some ideas that I believe could help, hopefully help in your deliberations. First of all, I think that we ought to have an immediate freeze on CO2 emissions and start the reductions from there. All the talk about prospective cuts. All the time we've been talking about prospective cuts, the emissions have continued to increase. I think we ought to have an immediate freeze. I remember that back in the days of the nuclear freeze, I was opposed to that, but it sure mobilized public opinion, and it helped. Senator Warner, when you and I and some others were working with Sam Nunn and Norm Dix and President Reagan, and we built a bipartisan coalition to move in the right direction, and we got it done. And freeze helped on that. Neither one of us was for it, but I'm for a freeze on carbon emissions, and then I think we ought to have reductions from there. Secondly, I think that we ought to use the tax code not to increase taxes, Senator Inhofe. I'm not for that. And what I'm about to propose to you, I'm fully aware, is considered way outside the range of what's considered politically feasible, so I advise you not to spend too much of your ammunition on it because people don't yet think it's going to be on the agenda. But here's what I think we should do. I think we ought to cut taxes on employment and take that burden off employees and employers and make up the difference with pollution taxes, principally CO2 taxes. Some other countries are talking about it seriously because in the developed world, we're now in a new competitive global environment, and our big disadvantage is these developing countries with big populations still growing significantly with low wage rates all of a sudden have access in an IT-empowered world to the best technology and container shipping, and we're competing with them. And we don't want to lower our wages, but we don't have to pile on top of the wages the full cost of our health and welfare and social security and social programs. We ought to be encouraging employment and small business and discouraging pollution instead of the other way around. And we ought to use some of that revenue to help the poor with the adjustments that are coming forward. Third, The third suggestion, I'm in favor of cap and trade as part of the freeze, very strongly in favor of it. And I've supported Kyoto, but I understand the realities of the situation. And I think the new president who takes office in January of 2009 should take office at a time when our country has a bipartisan commitment to de facto compliance with Kyoto. And then I think we should move the starting date of the next treaty period, now due to begin in 2012, forward 2 years to 2010. And we ought to start a sprint to negotiate and ratify a new, tougher treaty that starts in 2010. And we need to find a creative way to get China and India involved sooner rather than later. That's a tough challenge, and an important one for many reasons, not least because China's emissions will be larger than those of the United States in another couple of years. And it has to be a negotiation. And there are factors like land cover and methane that might be used to get them involved sooner rather than later. But we need to focus on ratifying a cap and trade system so the market will work for us instead of against us. I remember, incidentally, Senator Warner, when I was working on arms control under former President Carter, and the SALT II treaty was withdrawn from the Senate. And then President Reagan, after a few years, had even deeper reduction and called it START, and everybody was for that. I think it'll be good to have a new treaty. Let's comply with Kyoto, but let's ratify a new treaty earlier rather than later. Third, I believe that we ought to have a moratorium on any new coal plants that are not fixed with carbon capture and sequestration technology. It is simply irresponsible to go forward without carbon capture and sequestration. Fifth, I believe that this Congress, this Senate, should fix a date in the future beyond which incandescent light bulbs are banned. And there may be some other technologies that fall in that category. Give the industry time to make sure all the sockets are worked out and all the dimmers and all the things that people want. But then tell them by a date certain you're going to have to sell this other kind. They'll do it. They'll make money at it. It's like Walmart. Walmart's not taking on the climate crisis simply out of the goodness of their hearts. They care about it, but they're making money at it. And if we set the standards, our economy will work for us. Six, the creative power of the information revolution was unlocked by the Internet. And when the scientific and engineering pioneers came up with ARPANET, and this Senate empowered them with the legislative framework and research and development funds, all of a sudden, people just developed it amazingly. We ought to have an electronet, and we ought to encourage widely distributed power generation by homeowners, by small business owners. And here's the key. You ought to take off the cap, let them sell as much as they want to into the grid. And remember that the flip side of a monopoly is a monopsony, the tyranny of a single buyer. Don't let the utility in each area decide how much they're going to pay homeowners and business people for selling the electricity. Set the rate the way the Public Utility Commission does now. Have a tariff that's fair, that reflects the market price. You may never have to build another central generation power plant. You watch. You give them the ability. Individuals out there, families, small businesses, they're going to go to town with this, an electronet. Then I think we ought to raise the CAFE standards for auto efficiency. I do think it ought to be part of a comprehensive solution. Don't single out autos as the main culprit. It is part of it, and it's a significant part of it. And so we ought to raise CAFE standards as part of a larger package. Next, I would propose that you pass a Carbon Neutral Mortgage Association, or Connie Mae, and here's why. The buyers of new homes and home builders and sellers of new homes all focus on the purchase price. The market clears it. It's a very sensitive number. But the expenditures that go into more insulation and window treatments and the expenditures that don't pay back immediately, but they pay back over 2 or 3 years in lower energy bills, they're not used because they raise the purchase price. Put those in a separate instrument and have a Connie Mae that bundles those and sells them in the marketplace. Then when you go to a closing, you sign your mortgage and the banker and the seller say, now here's your Connie Mae here. This is going to lower your electricity bills. You're going to save, reduce CO2 at the same time. You ought to also, and I will respectfully recommend, and this is my last recommendation, require corporate disclosure of carbon emissions. Investors have a right to know about material risks that could affect the future value of the stocks that they purchase. They're not now routinely reported. You may know that just 2 days ago, pension funds managing a total of $4 trillion called upon the Congress and the SEC to require these disclosures. Now, finally, Madam Chair and Senators, as many of you know, the Chinese and Japanese way of expressing the concept crisis in the kanji characters uses two symbols. The first means danger, and the second means opportunity. And with all the focus on the danger of this crisis, which I think is the gravest we've ever faced, I want to close by reemphasizing my belief that it is also the greatest opportunity we've ever confronted. We can become more efficient and more productive. We can create more jobs and lift our standards of living. And in the process, we can save the habitability of this planet and tell that future generation that we were up to the challenge and we did what some thought was impossible. We did it on a bipartisan basis, and in the process, we gained the vision and moral authority in our generation to take on these other challenges that also need our attention. Thank you.
Thank you.